WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. James Brown was the godfather of soul, a revolutionary musician and dancer, and, says my guest today, James McBride, an icon that we have yet to truly understand. Someone whose legacy is as deep and complicated as that of America's relationship with race itself. This hour on Point, in search of James Brown. You can join us on air or online. Where this conversation is always on, how do you hear James Brown, his story? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is James McBride, author and musician himself. He won the National Book Award in 2013 for The Good Lord Bird, a comic novel set in the world of abolitionist John Brown. He's author of the super bestseller, The Color of Water, about his own upbringing as the black, mixed-race son of a white Jewish mother. His new book is Kill 'Em and Leave, Searching for James Brown and the American Soul. James McBride, welcome back to On Point. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for calling me James
Brown.
Yeah,
all the Jameses are in the house.
And That's right.
We're happy to have them, him and you and everything. This is a wonderful, wonderful book. It takes us deep. It takes us to some pretty dark places. It takes us into the bright, bright light of James Brown's music. There's a story you tell just at the end, and I wish you'd give it just a flavor of it, where you spend a little time with kids in the projects talking about music, and you want them to remember their music history, and you line up, you said, on your Apple, you know, on your, I guess, your laptop, a bunch of music for them to listen to, and sometimes they recognize it and sometimes they don't. And when you put on James Brown, what happens?
Their hands shoot in the air, and they holler his name. They holler it into history. They can remember James Brown. They forget, you know, Coltrane and Maria Callas and Ruben Blades. They get them all mixed up. And when I play James Brown's music, they instantly know who he is.
We're going to look at all the complexity of his story, as much of it as we can in this hour, but just explain to us, you're a musician, and you're a listener like the rest of us. We all know that feeling, but what is it? What was it about James Brown and his music that made it just such an indelible sound, so instantly recognizable, and gave it such a charge?
Well, and I mean, on a surface level, he was just a spectacularly gifted singer with one of the best, probably the best rhythm and blues band in history, made up of some musicians that came from the South who had grown up listening to Louis Jordan and the blues, and these guys, some of whom could read music and some who couldn't, were just extraordinarily gifted, especially Pee Wee Ellis and Fred Wesley, two of his musicians. But the other thing was that James Brown is really hollering through history. I mean, his whole persona really typifies and in many ways is a metaphor for how we see each other through the prism of race and also through the prism of North versus South, because he was really more of a Southerner than he was a black man.
I feel good like I knew that I would. I feel nice like sugar and spice, and millions of Americans know those instantly and know James Brown. Here was Try Me. This is 1959, a song that brought James Brown back to stardom in 50. This was in 58 after his first big hit, Please, Please, Please.
Try me, try me.
Brown, born in 1933. There he was, 1958, 1959. He would go well into this century. James McBride's book is Kill 'Em and Leave. James, give us the outline of his upbringing story, how rough it was.
Well, he was born in Barnwell, South Carolina. His parents split up when he was 5 or 6 or 9, if you depending on how old he really was. Mm-hmm. He was also raised in part by a sharecropping family that lived in Ellenton, South Carolina, which was a place that was later displaced by the building of the biggest nuclear bomb-making facilities the world had ever seen.
Wow.
He ended up in Augusta, Georgia. He lived with his great aunt who ran a, supposedly ran a brothel, but she ran a house where a lot of poor people lived. And then he was arrested at 16 and he went to jail. And he got a long prison sentence for stealing car parts. He served 3 years and a day. And then he came out and he was in North Georgia, a place called Toccoa. He met and married a, his first wife there. And during that time, he formed the Famous Flames and began his career, first in Macon and then later on in Atlanta and the bigger cities.
There was a speech he gave after the death of Martin Luther King in 1968 in Washington. He was imploring people to stop the violence in the streets. He would go on to sing about black and proud, I'm black and I'm proud. But here he was talking about a little bit about those beginnings and then a message. He says, not violence. Here's James Brown. This is 1968.
In Augusta, Georgia, I used to shine shoes on the steps of radio station WRDW. I think we started at 3 cents and we went to five and six. Never did get to a dime. But today, I own that radio station. You know what that is? That's black power. It's not in violence. It's in knowing what you're talking about.
James Brown, 1968, after the death of Martin Luther King. How did he come into that view of the world, and how did he come into this sound, his sound?
Well, he came into that view of the world because he grew up in the South where blacks and others were very conservative and believed in the system and so forth. And believed in hard work. He was not a champion of welfare, and he was not a champion of taking any kind of gifts or anything like that. It's true that he did own that radio station where he shined shoes, but he also lost that radio station when he was cleaned to the walls by the IRS twice in his life. His evolution really, the ups. I mean, his story is easy to tell for a music journalist who just wants to give like the Horatio Alger part of his life.
Yep.
He was poor, and then he got rich, and he became famous, and then later on he was an eccentric wild man, and then he just died, and that's, you know, that's show business. But it's a lot more complicated than that. He was really disappointed in some ways with how the evolution of black American life. The Augusta, Georgia that he loved ended up, you know, being a place of disappointment for him in some ways because of the, you know, the drugs, the crime, and the deterioration of the of black families and so forth, due to many problems that were beyond the control of many of these people. He was very, very complicated. He was shot. He was a sensitive, kind person who did not want people to know who he was.
There was so much that you would not know just watching him on stage. Just a little bit, 1964, James Brown and the Famous Flames played at the Teenage Music International show, stole the show from the Rolling Stones, who came after them, said it was the biggest mistake they ever made, the Stones said. Here was the song they opened with, James Brown, Out of Sight. You can see the video of this incredible performance at our website, onpointradio.org. Out of all that drama, tragedy, even fear, and we'll talk about it, James McBride, came this sound so tight, so polished, that perfect smile, that perfect hair. That was James Brown's effort to what?
Well, he was an entertainer, and he had to show his best face, which is how most Southerners were during that time. But also the other thing to remember is that as tight as his band was, they musically what they did was they were beginning to alter the form of the blues from the 1-4-5 to the 1-4-5 and then maybe to the one chord and then add an extra two or three or four bars so that he could put in his oohs and ahs or a dance spin and so forth. And that altering of the musical structure of the, you know, the normal blues is part of the way that James Brown changed American music forever, because after a certain point, he stopped going to the 4 and the 5 chord. He just stayed on the one, and then he began to do interesting things rhythmically with horns and guitars and drums that really set him apart from everyone.
We're going to look at that music. I'm just thinking of the image of James Brown, that unmistakable, one-of-a-kind image. You know, dances like Michael Jackson move over like we'd never seen. The energy of it, just explosive and unrelenting. Hardest working man in showbiz, people always said. Did he see that as a gift to the audience? Was it armor against the audience? You describe his fear of the white world.
Well, I mean, it was just a show. I mean, he got a lot of his moves and a lot of his stage persona from Louis Jordan, who came before him. With Louis Jordan and the Timpani Five often did these extraordinarily tight, you know, swing performances that would have people doing all kinds of the Charleston and all kinds of wild dancing because they were something to behold. I think he, you know, he just wanted to put on a really good show. That's how he saw it, but in a deeper way. I mean, if you saw Miles Davis or you saw the Philadelphia Orchestra when Eugene Ormandy, for example, was conducting it, you know, they were coming from a deeper place. And so my argument and my thesis in this book is that he really was dancing through history. He came from a deep historical place because South Carolina has a special place in American history. And not all of it is, you know, necessarily good, but it is special.
You call him the most misunderstood and misrepresented African-American figure in the last 300 years. Nearly as important and influential in American social history as, say, Harriet Tubman or Frederick Douglass. We'll look at that. James McBride is with us. He's written about James Brown. The book is Kill 'Em and Leave, Searching for James Brown and the American Soul. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can join us. Did James Brown make you feel good? Are those electric performances the definition of an icon? What about all that lay behind? 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. James McBride, please stand by. It's such a pleasure to have you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. There was a time when I used to dance. There was a time when I used to praise. But dig me now, baby. Don't worry about later. Dig the things I used to do. They call them mad potatoes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the real-life story of the godfather of soul, James Brown, the spectacular singer, dancer, performer, long known as the hardest-working man in showbiz. Novelist, memoirist, writer, musician, James McBride has gone deep on James Brown. His new book is Kill 'Em and Leave, Searching for James Brown and the American Soul. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can join us. Did James Brown make you feel good? Are those electric performances, the moves, the voice, the soul, the hair, the definition of an icon? Do you remember when that blazing smile would just take over a hall? Were you there? Are you surprised, saddened, to hear all the drama, tragedy behind the ball of fire on stage? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Papa's Got a Brand New Bag. This is live in New York, 1980. In his autobiography, Brown said the song changed everything for me and my music. I didn't need melody to make music. James McBride joins us from Washington. James, what's going on right here musically?
Well, they're burning it up is what's going
yes,
on.
Yes, they are.
By 1980, though, James Brown's great band had more or less vacated him. His greatest band was from about 1968 to maybe 1974, 75. By 1980, he was playing his songs at super fast speed, and of course it still sounded good, but it didn't have the same kind of grit and grime and that his innovation that his earlier bands had. And that was part of his problem, because by 1984, disco had more or less swallowed him whole, and he began to outrun his own musical revolution. That was one of the tragedies that visited upon him later in his life.
Let's hear a little bit from a little earlier then. Go back, 1967. This is Cold Sweat. Came out on an album, same name, influenced by the Miles Davis song So What, co-written by James Brown's bandleader, Pee Wee Ellis, who you mentioned. It's been called the first true funk song, Cold Sweat. When you kiss me.
Make everything all right. I make
James Brown could only be James Brown. Eugene in Duluth, Georgia, you are on the air with James McBride. Thank you for calling, Eugene.
Hey, Tom, how are you today? Enjoying your program.
Thank you so much. I'm very good right now. I feel good.
Yeah, I feel good, too. He was one of my favorite performers. He first recorded in Macon, Georgia, and was a contemporary of Otis Redding and some of my other favorites. I saw him three times in concert when I was in high school between 1967 and 1970. And, he just said it. He played a clip where he said he didn't need melody. Well, in my opinion, his best songs were melodic songs like Try Me.
Yeah.
He was amazing on stage. He was the greatest stage performer I have ever seen. And I got to tell you the truth. I appreciated him so much. And the later parodies of his on-stage performances that Eddie Murphy did on Saturday Night Live were just hilarious. And I'm just glad I had a chance to see him in person.
Eugene, let me hold that right there. And I'm so glad for all of that. I'll think of you in Chattanooga watching James Brown. Get one more right here. Terry in Florence, South Carolina. Terry, you're on the air. Thank you for calling, sir.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
I'm all right.
Love your show.
Thank you.
I'm doing wonderful. To me, James Brown was a revolutionary. He changed music. He was the conscience of the black community during the Jim Crow era, which was very difficult. A lot of African Americans were seeing downtrodden, and James Brown came in with a lot of uplifting songs. And to me, he's one of the greatest. And, you know, when I went to the elementary school.
Yes.
In a segregated school, and they had a dance contest to James Brown, and I think I was in the second grade, and I entered and won dancing like James Brown. But
all right,
now I'm older now, but it was beautiful back then. It still is. I love his music.
Terry, would you just put words to, you said he helped. He was the conscience of African Americans in the Jim Crow era, helped lift them. Explain that. How did he do that for you, for your family, your community?
Well, when he came out with Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud,
yeah.
I mean, that was powerful because it was a lot of isms that were going on during that era.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't quite understand it being so young, but I know it was a positive. I mean, I remember riding the school bus and African Americans were singing on the bus, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. We were just singing all the way home. So that kind of stuff made me conscious of the era that I was living at the time, living in the South.
Bless you, Terry. You call again. I really appreciate you bringing that school bus ride home to mind for all of us. That is just fantastic. James Bride, take us to the part of that deeper place that you're writing about that intersects with what Terry's talking about, how this music, this man, was speaking to people who were carrying a heavy cross.
Yeah, well, he was twice called upon after Martin Luther King's death to quell riots in two cities, Boston and in New York and in Washington D.C. In addition, he also had a big role in Augusta, I believe, in 1970 when there was some big racial upheaval there as well. I mean, he was very good that way, and he was always about education. And for blacks, he was like the uncle from down south who gets drunk and shows up at your house and takes out his teeth and says, "Stay in school," you know. But you loved him, and you know he loved you as well. But there's another part to that as well, mm-hmm. since this call is calling from South Carolina. And the fact is that James Brown left all of his money, his entire estate, his likeness, his music, his publishing, everything.
Everything.
In a fund to educate poor black and white children in South Carolina and Georgia.
$100 million yeah. plus or something like that it's valued at.
About at least $100 million mm-hmm. Worth.
Wow.
And 10 years later, not a single kid has received a dime of that money because it's been tied up in court with 48 lawsuits, 4,000 pages of testimony, some 90 attorneys, most of whom never knew James
Who's
Brown.
Who's tied it up? Family that didn't get what they hoped for or somebody
Some of his children who weren't included in the will, his last wife, if indeed she was his wife, and then the state of South Carolina. At one point, the Attorney General of South Carolina rewrote James Brown's will.
On what authority? How? Why?
Look, South Carolina is a different world. They have their own... Look, until 4 or 5 years ago, until a few years ago, there was only one law school in South Carolina, University of South Carolina. So all these guys know each other. This is mostly white guys. I'm not saying being racist, but this is the truth. They just simply have taken this man's will and his estate and flung it up for grabs. And it's like a dairy cow. They just bill each other. They just feed off of his estate. And it's been going on for 10 years. There needs to be some sort of federal intervention because the public, first of all, doesn't know about it that much.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, they just make up the rules as they go along.
$100 million for poor kids who could use that in their education. That's what James Brown wanted. You write a lot about the South behind James Brown. You talk about people who walk through that land, black and white, wearing masks and more masks, and masks beneath masks, tricksters and shapeshifters, magicians and carnival barkers. I wish you'd read a little bit from Kill 'Em and Leave, your new book, that gives us a sense of that geography of land and soul behind James Brown.
Okay. The South almost won the Civil War, and maybe they should have, because America's Southerners play act and pretend with a brilliance that is unmatched. They obstruct your view with a politeness and a deference that gives slight clue to the power within. Outside the looking glass, they are chameleons, whistling Dixie and playing slow and acting harmless and goofy. But behind their aw-shucks veneer, behind the bowing and scraping and moon pies and cigarettes and chit-chat about the good old Alabama Crimson Tide and hollering for the Lord, the unseen hand behind them is a gnarled, loaded fist prepped for a diesel-powered blow. If that hand is coming in your direction, get out of the way, or you're likely to find yourself spending the rest of your life sucking your meals through a straw. No one is more aware of the power of America's Southerners than the blacks who walk among them. There's an old slave saying, go here, go there, do nothing. And the descendants of those slaves are experts at that task. They do whatever needs to be done, say whatever needs to be said, then cut for the door to avoid the white man's evil, which they feel certain will, at some point, fall on them like raindrops. Brown, who grew up in a broken home and spent 3 years in a juvenile prison before he was 18, was an expert at dodging the white man's evil. He had years of practice covering up, closing down, shutting in, shutting out, locking out, placing mirrors in rooms, hammering up false doorways and floorboards to trap all comers who inquired about his inner soul. He did the same with his money.
You write that he was tremendous at dodging the evil, but he could not dodge the fear. And people in his inner circle, and you talked with a lot of them, point to this fear of what exactly when it came to the white world?
Well, I'll read from the book.
Mm-hmm.
Would that help?
Sure.
All right. Charles Bobbitt, James Brown's former manager, who for 41 years knew James Brown as well as many as any man on this earth, I asked him what Brown's truest, deepest feeling about the white man was. Bobbitt paused for a moment, looking at his hands, then said simply, fear. That fear, the knowledge that a single false step while wandering into the maze of the white man's reality could blast you back home with the speed of a circus artist being shot out of a cannon, is the kryptonite that has lain under the bed of every great black artist from 1920s radio star Burt Williams to Miles Davis to Jay-Z. If you can't find a little lead-lined room where you can flee that panic and avoid its poisonous rays, it will control your life. That's why Miles Davis and James Brown, who had similar reputations for being cantankerous and outrageous, seemed so much alike. Each admired the other from a distance. Those who knew them described them similarly, hard men on the outside, but behind the looking glass, sensitive, kind, loyal, proud, troubled souls working to keep the pain out, using all kinds of magic tricks, sleights of hands, and cover-up jobs to make everyone think the cool was at work, when in fact the cool was eating them alive. Keeping the pain out was a full-time job, and Brown worked harder at it than any black star before or after. Quote, you did not get to know James Brown, says his lawyer Buddy Dallas, because he did not want to be known. In 24 years of working with him, I have never known a person who worked harder at keeping people from knowing who he was.
James McBride, reading from his terrific new book, it is Kill 'Em and Leave, Searching for James Brown and the American Soul. 1972, here's King Heroin, one of the darker songs thematically that James Brown ever recorded, a poem set to music written from the point of view of the white powder, heroin.
I'm a world of power, and all know it's true. Use me once, and you'll know it too. I can make a mere schoolboy forget his books. I can make a world-famous beauty neglect her looks. I can make a good man forsake his wife, send a greedy man to prison for the rest of his life.
I can make a man forsake his country and flag. Make a girl sell her body for a $5 bag. Some think my adventure's a joy and a thriller, but I'll put a gun in your hand and make you a killer.
James Brown, His Own Way, 1972, King Heroin. He was very strict against drugs in his band, but at a certain point, they got some purchase on him. What was that about, James McBride?
Well, by then, you know, by the mid-'80s, his life began to fall apart. He was already married and divorced twice. His third wife had drug problems, and so did James Brown. And they had enormous marital issues, although he loved her dearly. She died of during a liposuction surgery operation in California.
Terrible.
He was in a lot of pain. He was in a lot of physical pain. His knees and his feet began to bother him because he'd danced so long. He'd done so much. And he was having a hard time getting his career on track. And again, he had enormous problems with the IRS because they had taken, they said he owed him $15 million. So his life, he was in pretty bad shape. He ended up hiring two very competent white Southern managers to resurrect his career. And they did. They got him out of tax trouble. They got him back on the road. They got him out of jail when he went to prison for this business that happened between him and the South Carolina and Georgia state troopers who arrested him. And then eventually, when his will was placed into the South Carolina court system, the same two white men who saved his career and resurrected his career were basically destroyed. I mean, one went to jail. The other went to jail, for in my opinion, for nothing. Mm-hmm. And the other, his attorney, was almost financially ruined. It's just another way that James Brown's life is a metaphor for how we can't talk to each other about situations involving money and race. And I'd also like to clean up something I mentioned before.
Yes, please.
I mean, it's true that most of the attorneys and judges involved in James Brown's current will fight are white men. I am not here to indict white men. But the fact is, this would not happen if he were Elvis Presley or John Lennon. And he could not have been popular in South Carolina anyway after he died, after he went through this business when he was arrested the last time and there was a national outcry that he should be released from prison. But the fact of the matter is that there's no reason, there seems to be, in my layman's opinion, there's no sane reason why this man who left everything to charity, and I don't know many stars who have done that, there seems to be no sane reason why this thing can't be shaken loose.
How do you interpret why this artist, this entertainer did that? $100 million, everything to this charity. Why?
Well, he had a lot to make up for. You know, he had terrible relations. He treated women terribly. And he had some outside children that he treated terribly. And he felt he had done, no small measure of wrong in his life. And part of that is because he just didn't know how to handle celebrity. And part of that was he felt like he was carrying the entire race on his back. James Brown was very proud. Even when he was broke, he would never do sneaker or beer commercials. He wasn't that kind of person. Mm-hmm. And the responsibility, I think, was just too much for him. He was very lonely at the end of his life.
James McBride is with us. His new book is Kill 'Em and Leave, Searching for James Brown and the American Soul. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org, and it's pretty terrific. James McBride, please stand by in Washington. Listeners, you can join us when James Brown sings Please, Please, Please. When he sings Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, what do you hear in the voice, the soul of James Brown? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. This is On Point.
Now, Bobby, I don't know, but whatsoever I play, it's got to be funky.
Yeah.
One, two, three, make it funky.
Make it funky.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Are we moving? We're talking this hour about the real-life story of the godfather of soul, James Brown. Novelist, memoirist, writer, musician, James McBride is with us. His new book is Kill 'Em and Leave, Searching for James Brown and the American Soul. You can join us. Can you picture what it took to blaze this trail? Can you see here the man, James McBride says, deeply feared white people, deeply mistrusted them? What's your question, your observation for James McBride on James Brown? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. James McBride, there's so much we want to learn, so many callers, though. Sandy in Norfolk, Virginia. Sandy, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hey, I just wanted to say I saw James Brown live in Virginia Beach in 1964. It was a small group. I don't think he had a backup band. All I can remember is him. And we fell in love with him. We were jumping up and down and shouting. And I've seen Mick Jagger, never seen Elvis live, never seen Michael Jackson, any of those live, but none of them compare to James Brown. And I tell you what, I go to YouTube every now and then and watch James Brown, and it makes my day. I feel good.
nourished, right there on YouTube. Sandy, I so love that. Move over, Mick Jagger and Michael Jackson, everybody else. Mamadou in Madison, Wisconsin. Mamadou, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Hi, James. I'm a big fan of you guys. Anyway, I'm originally from West Africa, Mali.
Great.
So everybody know, you know, the Malian music. So
sure.
I just want to testify how much James Brown was known and authentic and appreciated in the musician community and also in the intellectual community, you know, in Africa. I still remember when I was, you know, very young, my dad came to Chicago and he took back James Brown LP. And, you know, as much as I can say, James Brown music has a lot of influence on the Afrobeat, you know, like Fela, you know, like
Salif. Fela Kuti, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, Fela Kuti, Morikante. So he was a big icon. He was a well appreciated person, you know, his attitude and everything. He was a true African king.
Mamadou, I so love that you called with that. James McBride, can you picture that? This time, the influence not coming from Africa to the U.S., but James Brown's African-American sound with that influence back to West Africa, Fela Kuti and all the rest.
Oh, I'm sure of it. There's no question that his influence and his music was powerful, and your callers are calling in talking about how powerful and how much they loved him. There are other dimensions to the man. You know, I'd like to point out that while he had a fear of white people, he feared black people as well. He was very paranoid about certain things for good reason. I mean, he was very funny about money. He hid money a lot because he never had a lot of it.
He said he had a room in his house that he just hid cash in.
Yeah, he had a little red room, and he, you know, one day one of his accountant walked in there, and he opened up, James Brown opened up two cardboard boxes that were filled with $100 bills. And in fact, when he went to Zaire to play for the Muhammad Ali George Foreman fight, Mobutu, who was running the country at the time, made it clear he wanted to give gifts to all the performers. James Brown wasn't interested in that. He went straight to the airport, and he just
tried to give him a bag of diamonds. You report,
right? So he wasn't he was a proud person who liked to kill him and leave. He wanted to knock the audience out, and he wanted to just move on. He felt one of his sayings was to come important and leave important. And
none of this chit-chat at the back door. He would finish the show, go right under, did I get this right? Go right under a hairdryer to get his hair just right before he talked to anybody, and then out.
That's right. Yeah, he'd get under a hairdryer and talk, and wait, sit there and talk to Al Sharpton, who was at his feet for 15 years. He'd sit there and he'd talk for 3 hours, and when his hair was finished, he'd go out the door and he'd leave. He didn't do a lot of hobnobbing. He was competitive with everyone. He was competitive with Motown and Earth, Wind, and Fire, and the Stones. He did, you know, he was always trying to beat the other guy.
Could you explain that? Al Sharpton at his feet, at the same time, he was reportedly friends with Strom Thurmond. He supported Ronald Reagan. Paint that picture.
Well, he didn't care what James Brown did. You know, he didn't have any. In his mind, I don't think there's any difference between Ronald Reagan and Strom Thurmond. They were, to him, they were white folks with power, and, you know, he just wanted to keep the peace with them. But Al Sharpton, on the other hand, when you hear Al Sharpton talk, you are hearing James Brown speak. Because when Al Sharpton was 17 years old, he went on the road with James Brown for about 15 years. He left New York as Al Sharpton, the boy preacher, and he came back 15 years later as the Reverend Al Sharpton, with the hair and the medallion, all of his personal style, the way he wears his hair.
This is a revelation. Even the content, even his rhetoric, his ideas, the way he looks at the world?
I'm pretty sure. I mean, Al Sharpton would say things that James Brown would never say publicly. But he called James Brown his father. He called him the father that he never had. He talks about that in this book. I mean, he really, Al Sharpton understood James Brown better than most people who are alive.
That's incredible.
Now.
Incredible. And quite a showman himself, Al Sharpton. I mean, and yeah, I, now that you say it, I can kind of see it. James Brown is a mentor to him.
That's right. And he admired James Brown's showmanship. And James Brown admired Al Sharpton because, see, his son, Al Sharpton was friends with James Brown's oldest son who died in a tragic car accident. And so he kind of adopted Al Sharpton and made him like a child of his. And so he taught Sharpton how to deal with the public and how to deal with fans and how to show a persona of outlandishness yet grace, I'll put it that way. And then Al Sharpton was good for James Brown because Al Sharpton could go 360 degrees. He could talk to a president. He could talk to, you know, a thug. I mean, he was a guy who could really swing it any way he wanted to, and he was so verbose. James Brown liked that about him.
James McBride's new book is Kill 'Em and Leave, Searching for James Brown and the American Soul. Holly is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Holly, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thank you, Mr. McBride, for your fantastic observations. I played with Brown from 1975 till he passed away.
Wait, is this Holly Ferris? You were band leader for James Brown?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. I'm very glad you've called. Holly Ferris, what, trumpet, band leader, after Maceo Parker left.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I just wanted to address how determined Brown was to do certain things. Like, for example, the Apollo Theater live album, they told him, you can't do that. You can't do that. It's never been done in history. Can't do a live album. Well, he did it with his own money when the record company wouldn't do it. So that was his determination to do things, especially if you told him he couldn't do it. He would do it anyway. And pull it off.
James McBride, you're on the air with Holly Ferris, who was, I guess, band leader from 1975 until James Brown died. I'm glad to put you two together.
Well, you know, Holly Ferris saw a lot more of James Brown than I did, and he's very, you know, he has a reputation as being a very good musician, and he saw the evolution of James Brown's band, and he can probably tell you give you a better estimation of it than I could. But he's certainly right about how James Brown put together that live record at the Apollo. There are lots of things that James Brown did during Holly Ferris's time that were still somewhat revolutionary, although his real push into American music was from, say, 1959 until 1972 or 3 when Pee-wee Ellis and the others were still in the band. But then he came back, he had a big comeback, and that was during Holly's time. And Holly probably can tell you more about that than I can.
Well, Holly, listen with us for a second. I've got a little bit of James Brown here. We talked with Terry Gross on Fresh Air about 10 years ago and talking about this big shift in his music, maybe that you're talking about there, James, how he changed that emphasis of the rhythm from that second beat to the first beat. James Brown explains the difference.
The one that has syncopation. I mean, that's the difference. And you count it off, you right on the one. Bam, doom, bang, bang. And then the other one, you say one and a two, and two is the upbeat. And I'm on the downbeat. That's the difference.
Holly Ferris, you were the band lead for James Brown later on. How was it to work with him? And did he have to explain that anymore by the time you came in, or was that just the way the world worked? He had changed it.
That's just the way it was. He tried to explain it to many people, and nobody could quite understand what he was talking about. But for him, if the downbeat was there, then the rest of it was all gravy, you know, just so he had that downbeat to go off of, and everything else was cool.
Well, and
I'll do with the rest of this. Yeah.
I'll add what Holly's talking about, because I feel Holly can probably tell you some stories about working with James Brown.
Not always easy.
Yeah. But one of the things
that
James...
Another story about how determined he was. We played a gig in Argentina, he was already in his 70s, and he was so sick. He had IV fluids going in and a catheter. He pulled them out, went and did an hour and a half show, and came back and put them back in.
Oh, my gosh. That's the real deal.
He was to do a show.
It's the real... Holly Farris, we're so honored that you've listened and that you've called in, and we thank you for all your great music, and we thank you so much for calling today.
Well, it was an honor. Thank you.
Holly Farris, band leader for James Brown from 1975 on, calling in from Nashville, Tennessee. We're talking with James McBride. His new book is Kill 'Em and Leave. Here's Funky Drummer, a song that features what's said to be the most sampled drummer's loop in American history. Here's Brown calling for the drummer.
One, two, three, four, get it!
Lee in Boca Raton, Florida. Lee, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I just have a quick comment because I was born and raised in Augusta, Georgia, and it was a real thrill because we would see Mr. Brown in different parts of town, and during the 70s when he sort of lived right in the middle of town, so you would see him, and we used to, as a pack, would take our bikes and go hang out at the Dairy Queen. And we used to see him at the Dairy Queen. And one time we were all at the window waving at him and all that. And he parked his car. He always had big fancy Eldorados or Cadillacs. And he parked his car and he came into the Dairy Queen and he sat at a booth. And he just sort of chatted with us while he ate his ice cream. And we were all sort of sitting around eating our ice cream. He talked to us and he said, you know, where do y'all go to school? How old are you? You know, what do y'all do? And how's your summer going? And things like that. And so as a growing up there, I always just felt like he was a member of our community. And we would always see him around. And he was just always a delightful gentleman, always dressed up to the nines. And so that's really all my comment. And I look forward to reading the book.
Right out of Augusta, Lee, I'm so glad for your call. James, go straight to the deep place of race here. He could be that gentleman to Lee when she sat next to him at the Dairy Queen in Augusta. He also wrestled with some pretty deep demons here. Take us to your deep place observation about what we should see in James Brown when it comes to race in America.
Well, I mean, at the end of his life, he was seen as a kind of clown because he was, you know, he fell into drugs in middle age, and he was seen that way in the press and in America at large. I mean, I think that people know enough about James Brown and have had enough contact with him. I mean, the guy was, you know, on the road for 330 days a year. I'm wondering why, you know, if so many people loved him so much, why aren't they paying attention to what the man wanted to do, which was to educate poor white and black children in Georgia and South Carolina, where this lady's calling from. She's calling from Georgia.
She was
Georgia
going to Florida,
walked away from.
Yep. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, she lived in Georgia.
Yes, she did.
Georgia walked away from the whole estate fight, and they let South Carolina duke it out. And how's that? You know, how does that happen? I mean, if these people love James Brown, then show love for him by paying attention to the fact that the man had an estate that was valued at between 100, according to his accountant, was valued at between 100 and 150 million when he died. Now the valuation of his account that was given to the IRS, the last I heard, was $4.7 million.
Ow.
Now where's
Ow.
That money gone? That's... 90 attorneys, 48 lawsuits, the last wife, if she was his wife, because she was married before she married him and didn't divorce her husband, but somehow she was ruled to be his wife.
Yeah.
How does that work? And why aren't people paying attention? If you love the man, if you loved his music, which really is an ambassador for American culture worldwide, we've just heard it, from Africa
yep.
to the Far East, why is it that his final last wish to give everything back because he didn't live a pristine life, why is it that can't happen?
That's a big question, and we feel it. You make it burn. Here's Al Sharpton at his memorial for James Brown, Apollo Theater, New York, December 2006, after his death.
We've had many themselves icons. But we've only had one Godfather. And Harlem came out tonight to say goodbye to the Godfather. Not really goodbye, but so long, because every time somebody plays on a half beat, you still alive. Every time someone beats the odds, James Brown still lives.
Every time someone beats the odds, James Brown still lives. James McBride. We've got the point on the money, the outrage of what has happened with it, the poor kids who don't have it. Leave us with one other thing you would like us to remember about James Brown.
Well, his great innovation, really, was the fact that musically, he came up with this whole business of laying the heavy beat on the first bar of the third beat, in the third measure in the song. So you'd hear two, three, four, second bar, two, three, four, bang. That was one of his greatest innovations. And we're dancing to that to this day.
James McBride tells kind of incredible story of searching for the heart of this man, bringing us the world that made him, and through the eyes of many who knew him well, how he lived in it, how he responded to it, the music he made. The new book is Kill 'Em and Leave, Searching for James Brown and the American Soul. James McBride, it is always fantastic to have you. We're very grateful to you for being here today. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Baby, 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 I got the feeling, baby.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.